Welcome to the V-Wave Podcast. This podcast is brought to you by River Runners for Wilderness and is created by a cast of river lovers who understand the river resource comes first. On the shoulders of a healthy river do we recreate ourselves. What comes second is river access, a very thorny V-Wave, all in itself. The V-Wave discusses these things and river ecology, recent river trips, river history, river management, and new changes on rivers. Have a topic you'd like to hear more about or help discuss? Get in touch with me, your host, Tom Martin, at rrfw.org. That's T-O-M-M-A-R-T-I-N at rrfw.org. Special thanks to Char and Trev, who came up with this idea. Today's V-Wave podcast is with Dennis Willis. And the discussion today is on rec.gov. Dennis Willis, welcome to the V-Wave. How are you today?
Oh, thank you. Very well.
Dennis, would you mind to give our listeners just a brief summary of your work career?
Okay, sure. I retired in 2009 after 35 years with the BLM, a little bit of Forest Service time in there. Always had a love of outdoor recreation and started out in the rangeland management program, but I always figured out ways to worm my way into recreation programs where I could. In 1990, I had the opportunity to switch from rangeland management to recreation, which I immediately did because I know growth industry when I see one. And the recreation folks are, for the most part, happy to be alive, easy to work with folks, whereas the ranchers tend to be a little more grumpy. So I made that switch. During the last 12 years of my career, it was I had 25% of my time assigned to the Washington office. And while I was there, I was dealing with national policy issues, and I was with a team, and we developed and finalized the recreation permitting regulations and provided guidance to the BLM as to how to implement those, developing annuals, handbooks, and going out and doing on-site training in the field. Did some work on the America the Beautiful Pass program, and also had dealings with recreation.gov.
Okay, can you go back in the Wayback Machine to see where the concept of rec.gov kind of came from and how it kind of morphed into where we're at today?
Where it came from was there was I'm talking early 90s now. There were a whole hodgepodge of reservation systems for campgrounds primarily.
Okay.
And there were a lot of campgrounds that were first come first serve. There were a lot of campgrounds that had reservation systems, but they were run through the local office, so you needed to be able to find out, not only what the name of the campground was, but which Forest Service or BLM unit was managing it, and then how to get into their reservation system. And there was a group called the, I believe it's the American Recreation Coalition, might be wrong on a number of groups, but there was this group that was largely a consortium of RV manufacturers and people that cater to the Winnebago tribe, the KOAs of the world,
okay,
that kind of thing. And they had this vision and started putting pressure on the agencies of, hey, wouldn't it be great if you could put together reservations seamlessly in one place for your RV summer where you're going to go coast to coast and stay in all these campgrounds. And that was the vision of rec.gov. And then once that was coming online, there was pressure through the agencies for those individual offices to, if they had reservation campgrounds, to put those on to rec.gov. And if they didn't have reservation campgrounds, to make them into reservation campgrounds. So that the Winnebago tribe could realize their dream of being able to plan out every day of their whole summer in January and be guaranteed that they would have a campsite wherever it was they were heading.
So Dennis, I'm going to jump in here and say, gosh, you know, in principle, I can understand the need for that. And of course, with a website like rec.gov, I assume it's being operated by a government agency that has no skin in the game to force permits or to try to sell permits. How did this, that's not what is behind rec.gov. How did it morph into a for-profit center really doing the yeoman's work to push permit acquisition, where those permits are used or not?
Basically, the rec.gov got to be too big for the agencies to handle. It was requiring more IT expertise, more computer expertise, that type of thing. The agencies really didn't love doing it, so it's basically been contracted out.
Okay.
And the current contractor is Booz Allen Hamilton, which is one of the largest federal contractors in the country. They do all kinds of stuff besides rec.gov. They're heavily involved in environmental issues, heavily involved in national defense, national security. They are a huge company with their feathers and a lot of pies. And the way rec.gov operates is they make $6 on any reservation that gets made or any application to a lottery, like a river permit lottery, that they make $6 for every application. Well, obviously, it doesn't cost $6 to handle one of those, so the economies of scale are such is that the more people you can get making reservations, the more money that the contractor makes, because that's basically where they make their money on the contract, is they get to keep that $6. The actual creation fees themselves go back to the agency office that generated them.
So while the citizen might pay $25, only $19 of that $25 goes to the agency.
Right, and that's made pretty clear on rec.gov. You'll see it broken out. The $6 is a separate charge.
Right, but it doesn't go to the agency. Whereas in the past, when the agency was operating the system, it did. Is that right?
You're going way, way back
in
history on that.
Yeah, going back a ways. Okay.
Yeah, but then once once contractors got involved with it, there was a lot more interest in from the rec.gov contractor of bringing more things in, including special recreation permits for things like river permits, backpacking in permitted areas, all of those kinds of things. And those systems are very complex and varied, and they're complex and varied because they are tailored to specific resource situations. That's why That's why the number of trips per day, for example, is different on the San Juan than it is in Westwater, than it is on the Selway, than it is on Idaho rivers.
Mm-hmm.
And the contractor vision is, hey, we can treat all of these like they were Holiday Inn Central Reservations. And those Western agencies that were running those programs said, no, you can't. It's way more complex than just whether you rent a hotel room or not. So anyway, there was a lot of pressure, you know, people saying we need to migrate to rec.gov, and which, of course, we know many of our rivers and backcountry areas have done that. But as a result, the contractor did wind up having to spend a lot more money because they basically had to write new software because you fill the calendar for Desolation Canyon differently than you fill it for the Middle Fork of the Salmon, differently than you do to climb Mount Whitney. And so basically each program that had reservations that way or had lotteries had to get their own separate coding software, whatever, developed to accommodate that. So, you know, that $6, it doesn't cost $6 to process my name on a river application, but they did spend a whole lot of money to set that system up for whatever river segment we're talking about.
So how does that work? A rec planner that works for a National Forest or BLM or National Park Service unit sits down with the contractor, Bruce Hamilton, and says, this is how our system works, and make a plan to fit it.
Correct. Yeah, basically that's it. It's more complex than that. There is an official agency liaison to rec.gov. For many years, that was Sherry Hughes out of Idaho, and she worked for the Forest Service and to the Idaho rivers, and she had a real good understanding of being able to translate what the individual offices wanted to do to the rec.gov computer gurus.
Okay.
And one of the things in that process that she found out is that there were a lot of offices that didn't truly understand their own system.
Okay.
When you really got into the weeds of it. So, but there was a lot of pressure to, you know, move things under rec.gov because permit systems take time and money and attention. And the Natural Resource Agency, I don't care if we're talking Park Service, Forest Service, BLM, Fish and Wildlife Service, those agencies have flat been starved for budget and positions. And so here was an opportunity to offload some workload.
On one side I can see makes a lot of sense. On another side, looking at it, it looks to me like a giant leap for mankind toward commercializing our federal lands. Uh-oh.
Yeah, there's a certain amount of that. I'm not so concerned about the commercialization aspects of it. I mean, if you have to get a permit to do something, you got to get a permit to do something.
Well, that's different. No, the permit, to get a permit, I think that's it, speaking to carrying capacity and saying,
right,
we can only let so many people in. But the distribution of those permits by a for-profit business,
mm-hmm,
that's where the commercialization is coming in. This isn't about
right,
a private tour company running into a recreational group that is doing it themselves. That's a different discussion. This is about
right,
who administers the permit system to recreate on federal land. Mm-hmm. And what is their motive to do so? You know, it clearly is to make money. I'm wondering, when the agencies were doing it, were the agencies doing it with a financial outcome in mind? Because they could have been.
No, I actually wrote a paper on that, on application fees.
Okay.
And you know, there was a vision that, well, if we charge an application fee, that the number of applications will be constrained, and only people that are really serious will bother to apply for it. And there was also the, you know, it costs us money to deal with all of the stuff you need to deal with in the permit, and it's more fair to spread that out among all the people that apply to and use the system rather than just those who actually get the recreation experience. I can see some value to that. Where my concern comes in with the commercialization is every year, you know, we all get little notices from rec.gov saying, oh, river permit lottery season is here. Don't forget to put in on all these different rivers that you can put in on, and so everybody's, you know, dutifully putting in and sending in their $6, and people that have no ability or, you know, wherewithal to actually go do the experience wind up doing it because they're sitting at home on a cold January night and wow, an Idaho river trip sounds like fun. And anecdotally, I will tell you what I hear back from river rangers is that they are seeing more people show up who found out about the given river segment through rec.gov, and that's where they found out about it. And so they went down and bought their Walmart raft because they got their permit and you know, they're showing up at the put-in and they really don't have the work all to be doing what they're doing. And Tom, we're being a little, river centric here. One, because most of my permitting experience is with rivers. And two, I love rivers. And I'm guessing with your audience, it's okay that we're talking more that way than throwing in climbing Mount Whitney.
Absolutely. This is the V-Wave podcast, after all.
Okay.
And so
okay.
No problems.
All right. Well, you know, a couple of concerns is one, we went into permits because we had carrying capacity and management issues. And so the number of permits is constrained, and there were more people wanting permits than we could satisfy. So then we came up with, okay, what's a fair way to allocate it? Lotteries are a fair way to allocate it. And to my mind, if you went into a lottery system because demand was outstripping supply, and you don't have any way to increase the number of permits, it's not like the Holiday Inn where you can add another 100 rooms.
Right.
That to my mind, it is immoral to be juicing the demand side in the lottery. At that point, you're in the business of selling lottery tickets. You aren't in the business of providing recreation experiences.
Yes, so, at this point, rec.gov is financially motivated to get everybody in the company, everybody in the country to apply for a permit to run whatever river it is so they can make their $6 off everybody in the country. They don't care about whether, you know, anybody wins the lottery, or what those people do when they show up at the ramp. That's not their department. Their job is to get as many people into that lottery as they can.
Correct.
And so that's a really valid concern you're raising there, saying we're juicing a system, is a good word you used, that is already overrun with applicants.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then we get into issues of, you know, that guy in Vermont or the college frat guy in wherever that got a wild hair to apply for this river lottery. When they figure out that, you know, the logistics and the expenses of doing it are way more than what they counted on, unless there's some real robust cancellation turnover, management of cancellations and turnovers and disincentives to cancel, then we wind up with a lot of vacancies on the launch calendar, which causes me heartburn, because I know there are people out there that would love to have the opportunity to do that trip, and they can't because, you know, yep, some Walter Mitty person.
Well, it's fun. Problem. Wait a minute. I just see the average person that has a family that wants to recreate, gets swept into rec.gov and sees, hey, we make experiences. Gosh, that sounds great. It's a very nice catchy title there. So I'm going to sign up for this river trip, and I'm going to go out and try to buy some gear. I don't know that much about it. I'm going to try. And then I get into it. Because I've been sold into it, I get into it and look around and go, whoa, this is way over my five-year-old's head. I'm going to back out. Now I'm going to get slammed by having some high cancellation fees or some sort of holy terror is going to rain down on me for not showing up. Now, I agree with you that cancellations need to be addressed, but how do you keep the American public that wants to recreate... how do you keep those people from not wanting to recreate anymore because the disincentives are so great that they might as well just stay home or take the kid to the park?
It's where I am. I sold my boat last year.
Okay.
Broke my heart. First time I haven't owned a river boat since 1979.
I was going to say, Dennis, how old, I mean, don't mind me asking, how old are you?
I'm 70.
Okay, so if I may be so frank, you may be selling your boat, just like I'm thinking to sell my boat, because we are timing out structurally, physically, the ability to actually put a boat on the water and take it somewhere. I'm sort of thinking...
I've never heard in my life. No, you're right. There is some validity to that as well.
Yeah, and I'm thinking of a 30-year-old that's got a 5-year-old kid or a 10-year-old kid. And you know how to come up with a system that doesn't commercialize the resource, that is fair to the people that want to recreate there, that realizes, as you point out, there are only so many permits to go around for these incredible resources that.
Yeah.
The managing agencies are being defunded, de-staffed, and are supposed to still manage these places. It's we're in a sort of a terrible bind here.
Yeah, and part of it falls to the river community. I'm sad to say, when we were running our own system, and Desolation was one of the last rivers to with an existing permit system to come under recreation.gov, just because I personally fought it off for years. You had to call and give your name, and we used a contractor for that. You had to give your name and address and request an application. We would mail you an application. You would stick a stamp on it, fill it out, mail it back in, and then we would run that through the lottery. But anyway, there was a bit of sweat equity involved in being able to play in the permit system.
Okay.
And we kept hearing from our community, you know, you guys need to go to recreation.gov. I just want to be able to sit at my computer and you know, type my stuff in, and I don't even have to type it in because once you've entered it, it's already there. All I got to do is choose my dates and get out my credit card, and I'm done. It's easy. I don't have to make calls. I don't have to put stamps on things.
It's funny because I can imagine a certain subset was asking for that, but I can imagine another subset was saying, go, Dennis, go, run, 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 keep this thing out of rec.gov.
Actually, no. I wasn't hearing that. I was hearing that people wanted the convenience.
Huh.
And it's only been in the last few years. I'm no longer working, but I still have a lot of connections in the river community.
Right.
That it's only in the last few years that I've been hearing people say, you know, that wasn't such a bad system where you had to work a little bit and show a little commitment to permit. Because the problem is now is that you don't have any sweat equity in it at all. You got $6.
Right. Right.
And another part of it that falls to the river community is quite frankly, folks are, and part of it is the way the agency has the system set up, in Desolation Canyon, people confirm their permit, pay for one person, so they're out $25, I guess now it's $50, whatever. They're out a relatively small amount of money compared to the cost of a trip. And it was a great idea in January, February, March, but come the summer and in the fall particularly, we had a problem with a real high no-show rate because people were just walking away from $50 essentially.
Okay.
Or $25 when it was $25 and they wouldn't cancel the permit. They just were no-show, let it turn into a pumpkin. And so, I mean, that's another place where there's pressure on the system. People are being denied opportunity. And in that case, it's people in the river community that are doing it to each other.
So what would you sort of, all right, looking in the rearview mirror now at kind of how we got into this, what are the concerns of today? One being a very high or certainly a no-show rate where if you knew that person wasn't coming, you could put it out there and possibly catch someone who would be able to show up on a much shorter turnaround time between permit and launch. Mm-hmm. What do you think is a way forward here that doesn't allow for runaway boosterism to get a permit? If it's a lottery, you have to play. You can't win unless you play, which is of course the great lottery jingle. Mm-hmm. All right. So once you're in, if you do win the permit, what can the agency do, whether it's Deso Gray or Grand Canyon or anywhere else, to help the permittee actually get to the trailhead or the put-in or wherever and have a decent experience?
That's a problem, and part of the problem is when agencies were running their own permit systems in-house at local levels, you had somebody who was watching that system like a hawk.
Okay.
And if there, you know, and if there were problems with cancellations, if there were problems with no-shows, if there were problems with whatever it might be, that they would go ahead and you know, take some action to deal with it. What I tend to see in agencies, and not just with rivers, but even with campgrounds and campground reservations, is they get it turned over to recreation.gov, and done with that. We never have to think about our permit system again.
Okay.
We never have to look at what the actual utilization of our resources are. You know, rec.gov takes care of all that, so we don't need to worry about it. And part of that is a function of agencies being terribly understaffed and not having the personnel to do that. And the other is just human nature of people being under stress and, oh, somebody's taking this responsibility off my plate so I don't have to worry about it anymore and I can deal with one of the other things that's out there demanding my time and attention.
Right. So the agency is looking the other way. Understood. They're understaffed, underfunded. I get that. What would be a way to... and it sounds like you're saying the way to deal with this is actually, are you talking about trying to outreach to the permittee 6 months out, 3 months out, 3 weeks out? Are you coming? Are you going to be here? We will give your permit away if you're not. Let us know. I mean, what would you do to sort of reach out to people to actually draw them in? Look, you have a permit. It's a valuable permit. We really want to see you here. Come recreate.
Yeah.
How to draw people to the activity instead of doing nothing and then they don't show up, blame them. What's another way of doing this?
Well, the things that I have thought about, and I'm not in a position to do any of them anymore, but for example, when we were running it ourselves in-house, we had an unofficial policy that if you drew a permit in the lottery, when you confirmed your permit, you had to confirm for at least half of your total group size. So if you confirmed for 4, you could go with more than 8,
okay.
Which made people think about and plan their trip a little better. Because what's going on now, and we had people back then that wanted to do the same thing, let me confirm it for just 1, and then I'll see if I can put a trip together and one thing and another. You know, requiring a little more commitment up front. Is worthwhile, and then they had to pay for the full amount at least 30 days out, and if their permit wasn't paid for 30 days out, we would cancel it and immediately make it available. We usually knew that there were people who were desperate for permits, and we knew who those people were, and we would very frequently. They call people that we knew were looking for a launch on a given date, sort of an unofficial waiting list kind of situation. But people that were really motivated to go were letting us know they were motivated to go. The 30-day thing, we did some playing around with Desolation Canyon, looked at a lot of cancellations, and basically we found that if we had a cancellation 30 days out, we had a 90% chance of refilling that cancellation. If we got it 15 days out, it was almost zero chance of filling it.
Oh, wow.
So that's why we set the 30-day thing. Now, I could imagine on some place like Westwater that has, large suburban to semi-urban boating communities within a half-hour drive,
right.
There you might be able to deal with a shorter cancellation rate, but with Desolation being a week-long trip, most people needed at least a month of planning horizon.
Okay, yeah, sure.
So, there's some things that could be done that way. We thought about requiring some kind of a bond. You put up $500, and when you show up and launch your trip, we'll refund it for you. In addition to permit fees, because there just isn't enough. There isn't enough of a financial incentive. There's not a trip out there that the permit, in the scheme of things, isn't one of the lower cost items to do on the trip.
Right.
You're not going to walk away from doing a $3,000 trip. Or you're not going to do a $3,000 trip because you're afraid to walk away from $50.
Right. Right.
It's
interesting when I think of the Grand Canyon River concessionaires. There's a fixed number of those concessionaires, and they charge going on $1,000 a night per person,
uh-huh.
And they require a substantial deposit to the tune of $600 per person. I'm assuming that they are trying to suck those people to the launch ramp and not have them walk away. As soon as those people do walk away, they will rebook that seat and they will keep that $600. So there's also a financial incentive for them, whether the person makes the trip or not. You know, they turn around and resell that seat, they keep that money.
It isn't just Grand Canyon boating. I mean, if you look at commercial recreation, you know, try booking a cruise on a cruise ship, or try booking into a high-end resort. You know, those folks are going to want real substantial non-refundable deposits. A lot of them, you pay for 100% upfront. And unless you buy insurance or something like that, the cancellation policy is they keep the money. And hopefully they're hoping that they will be able to rebook it as well.
So I could see Bruce Hamilton would look at this and go, whoa, here's another way we can make a lot of money. We will force these people to pay this big amount of money. A lot of them are going to cancel, and we will be able to double book. Well, I mean, how do we avoid that slippery slope?
Well, because those recreation fees should come back to the agency.
Ah.
You know, Bruce Hamilton still is not getting any more than their $6 per application.
Okay.
But the problem is, you know, there's a big difference in the financial incentive for a $3,000 cruise or luxury ski vacation, as opposed to a few hundred dollars in river permit fees. You know, you might not walk away from your $3,000 cruise because cousins is getting married that weekend, but it's pretty easy to walk away from $100.
Right, so but putting forward a bond. Let's talk about that. So there's a $500 or $1,000 bond. You're trying to show commitment. Well, that bond is going to shear off some people.
That's why nobody's done it.
Okay.
and why I don't like it, frankly, because there's just a whole lot of people that don't have that extra $500 worth of room on their credit card, and I don't want to price people out of it.
Right.
But I do want to make sure that we are making launches available.
Right. And I, you know, kind of looking forward in the crystal ball, I just see this getting worse because our population is going up and up. Our demand for outdoor recreation is going up and up. Our number of recreation areas, I mean, I'm sorry, Dennis, I just haven't gotten my shovel and gone over there to volunteer for you to make another Desolation Canyon. You know, because, boy, if we had 10 Deso Canyons, that would be great. Then we could at least, you know, deal with today's demand. But we don't. We only have one Desolation Gray.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we have a system that draws people in and gets them to the launch, pushes them away in their watercraft, and says, have a good time? Instead of setting a system up where it's easy to exit before you get to the put-in. And that causes problems for everybody else who'd hoped to get a launch.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think the answer might be a lot of little things.
Okay.
You know, going back to sweat equity, and, you know, you have to request an application and stick a stamp on it. You know that getting some commitment up front, rather than just having all these people, putting in because it sounds like fun in January,
right? Okay.
And also requiring more commitment up front, and I know it varies with the river and their system. But in Deso, confirming for one person to hold the permit, that's just showing me that it's not working.
Right.
They need to change that system. Agencies need to look at their individual situation, what cancellation rates are, and do what they can to bring those cancellation rates down. And it might not be the same answer on every river segment.
Okay.
you know, another concern that I have with the whole situation is I'm seeing more and more emphasis in the river community to filling permits to help facilitate getting people down the river, which is increasing the average group size. And that has ramifications for capacity. And for example, in Desolation Canyon, the maximum group size is 25. For years and years, the average commercial down there was 12 to 18. The average private was 6 or 8. So the group sizes were a lot smaller than the maximum 25.
Okay.
And so people were able to use smaller sites because we don't have that many huge, big sites, particularly at higher water levels.
Mm-hmm.
So anyways, if everybody starts going with a maxed out trip of 25, we're going to run out of campsites. And at that point, we need to give some serious consideration to capacity. In the case of Desso, the capacity was established in large part based on the availability of campsites and everybody being able to get one. Well, if everybody needs a huge one, particularly at higher water levels, we might not be able to sustain that. Or there might need to be some discussion in the community about, you know, changing what the nature of the experience is. And I love the wilderness experience and knowing that my camp is going to be out of eyeshot, out of earshot of anybody else's camp.
Right.
But, you know, maybe people are willing to forego that. I would not be.
Right.
But maybe people are willing to know that for the opportunity to be on the water.
And then the very reason to be on the water goes away because there's a zillion people there.
Right.
Traction sites are crowded. Right. Campsite competition is great. Because there's too many people there.
And it depends on the river segment to a certain degree. I mean, we do have some, you know, splash and giggle daily segments.
Right.
Where crowding is really not an issue. But if we have something like the Middle Fork or Desso or wherever, where the primary reason for people going there is wilderness experience,
right,
then the social crowding becomes a bigger issue.
That's right. And there, boy, the pressure, I hear that from people just saying, well, they're not letting out enough permits. We should just put in more permits. And I'm like, wait a minute, the place is already overcrowded. The recreational experience is already degraded, but you don't know that because you've only been boating a short amount of time. And, you know, it's the people on the motorboats in Grand Canyon saying, gee, this is a great experience. Well, you're on a motorboat in the canyon. Back in the days before there were motorboats, you know, people looked at motorboats askance. And now, you know, the motorized crowd says, well, it's great. We get to go through in 5-6 days, and, man, it's all right. Looking at it today, and they don't understand the rearview mirror, where we have come from to get to where this is today. People today saying, gosh, it didn't seem too crowded to me. You want to let in more, you know, more launches every day? Go for it. Looks good.
Mm-hmm.
Where the long-term people go, oh, wait, it was really crowded compared to what it was so many years ago.
Yeah, well, in some places, though, you know, aren't overcrowded because the capacity was established a long time ago, and,
yes,
and you know, the lid was on before the pot boiled over.
Right. Yeah, and other places, it just seems like the agency retreats every time they do a management plan. They let more permits on, more people on, because mm-hmm. the pressure, you know, people are just clamoring for that, and it's really hard to say, you know, the quality of the river experience here is going to degrade, and the public says, fine. We'll take that. Just let us go. We know what's a manager to do.
And then there are a lot of managers out there that don't understand how the system works. When we were redoing the plan, redoing the river plan, but the RNP plan for price, we had some managers that were doing the math and saying, well, we'd make a lot more money because our capacity is as of 25, we should just issue permits until we have 150 people a day launching, which of course would completely swamp the campsites. And you know, they did not understand how the capacity worked that way.
That's 10 groups of 10 groups of 15. That's 20 groups of 7 or 8. Where are they all going to go at the end of the day?
Yeah, well, I finally got them to kind of see it a little bit, because they're pretty much front country travelers. And I said, would you be willing to go to a hotel where they were going to book until all space was taken?
Right.
You know, so yeah, you booked a room, but you've got 2 queen beds, so we're going to put 3 other people in there with you.
That's right. Because there's an empty bed there. That's a stupid way to manage it. Yeah, let's fill that bed up. Sure, that's a very good example. So, Dennis, I'd like to ask you, what is your synopsis of recreation, outdoor recreation today, whether it's BLM or Forest Service or National Park? How would you size up what you see today and what you're worried about tomorrow?
Sure. Just kind of general observation from my point of view. You know, there's that famous Martin Luther King quote about the arc of the universe bending towards justice.
Yes.
I think the arc of outdoor recreation is bending towards big money and fancy marketing. We just are seeing more and more specialty gear and clothing coming up from the outdoor industry. You know, we don't run into people out there anymore that scrounge thrift stores, flea markets, and military surplus stores to outfit themselves to be able to get out there and enjoy themselves. You know, everything's got to have a Patagucci label on it. From the agency side, we're seeing higher fees from agencies, they are getting higher fees from some users, and that's falling predominantly on non-motorized backcountry users who are paying for everything in their program, plus a little extra for those users that don't contribute. So we see those backcountry monies being diverted to other things. Hmm. You know, we're seeing campgrounds. You know, campgrounds used to be quaint little semi-primitive things. And now we're having these huge complexes or, you know, hundreds of vehicles, hundreds of camp spots instead of a dozen to 20. And they're designed and built for the biggest luxury land yachts made. And the fee structure of the agencies, I think, is skewed to benefit the wealthy. I was just looking recently at camping at Mesa Verde National Park. And their campground fee is $38 a night for a dry tent site, and only $51 for a full RV site with full hookups.
Whoa.
And so why does a dry tent camp cost 75% of what an RV site with hookups costs?
Right.
I don't understand that one. You know, skiing, you know, we've seen that get ridiculous. You know, with people paying $1,500 and up for various season passes, or $300 a day for day passes, and then with all kinds of options to buy extras that let you cut lift lines or get on the mountain an hour earlier than the poor folks who could only afford a day pass. And I have real concerns for that over what that means towards social equality and egalitarianism, you know, in our system. And clearly, I mean, that's an example of money purchasing access to outdoor recreation. That's a huge... Go ahead.
Well, I just think of the commodification of our federal lands and the commercialization of our federal lands.
Yeah, and that is a concern. You know, we have seen proposals before Congress, you know, to privatize recreation facilities. privatized campgrounds, picnic areas, you know, whatever can be privatized and somebody can make a buck off of getting it out of the federal sphere and privatizing it.
Right. Well, that certainly happened here in Sedona, not far from Flagstaff, mm-hmm. where I live, and, you know, the Red Rocks Pass. You get the pass from the agency, but that pass doesn't get you into a campground. You have to pay, again, to the company that is operating the campground.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a pass that the money goes to the agency. No, you got to pay a pass to the agency, but then you got to pay more money to use an amenity, a campground, to somebody else.
Right. And that campground was likely built by the agency.
Correct. That's right.
And the agency is probably responsible for heavy maintenance when toilets need to be replaced or roads need to be rebuilt or whatever. The agency is probably on the hook for those.
One would assume. Okay. So, all right.
Yeah, but to my mind, it's a challenge that we need to have the American outdoors be a legacy and a right of all Americans to access, and the trend towards, frankly, pricing people out is not helping in that regard.
Understood.
Okay. Well, Tom, we have well exceeded the 30 minutes that I promised you.
We have. I'm so grateful. So grateful. Thank you for doing that. Dennis Willis, thank you very much for this V-Wave podcast. I look forward to talking to you again about all this in the near future.
Okay.
All right. Thanks so much. This will conclude this V-Wave podcast.
Okay.